loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, people around the world yesterday mourned the assassination of a 21-year-old Palestinian medic, Razan Al-Najjar, who was shot and killed by Israeli snipers as she was tending to wounded protesters. Razan is the second health worker killed by Israeli snipers and one of more than 100 Palestinians killed in the past few weeks. The Israeli military said they would conduct an investigation into her death. Also today marks the 51st anniversary of the so-called Six-Day War, which was a quick and decisive victory for Israel over its Arab neighbors and the conquest of additional Arab territories that remain occupied even today. And then we continue our weekly series every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism, the big economic news stories of the week, with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Iranian government yesterday informed the United Nations nuclear watchdog that it planned to begin the process of increasing its capacity to enrich uranium. The Iranian decision was taken in light of the U.S. withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran, nuclear deal. Next, President Trump yesterday disinvited the entire Philadelphia Eagles football team from a White House event celebrating their Super Bowl victory because a handful of players were not planning to attend. The president was offended that individual players were boycotting the event, and he released a statement criticizing them and alluding to the controversy over kneeling during the national anthem. Then, the Pentagon is increasing spending on a secret research effort to use artificial intelligence to help anticipate the launch of a nuclear-capable missile, as well as to track and target mobile missile launchers. If the effort is successful, such computer programs will be able to think for themselves. And then prosecutors representing Special Counsel Robert Mueller yesterday accused former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort of jury tampering. They say that Manafort has attempted to influence the testimony of two witnesses in his upcoming criminal trial, and they're asking a judge to revoke his bail and send him to jail. And finally, the Supreme Court, by a 7-2 vote, ruled yesterday that a Colorado cake shop owner did not have to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. The ruling was narrowly written and specific only to this case, but experts believe that it will encourage other people to file anti-civil rights cases based on religious freedom arguments. And in other headlines, video just released by The Intercept shows how Montgomery County, Maryland police broke recently into Chelsea Manning's home with guns drawn. The police claim they were simply checking on Manning to make sure she was okay following two apparently suicidal tweets sent on May 27th. Manning, who was out of the country at the time but released the security camera video to The Intercept, said, quote, "This is what a police state looks like, guns drawn during a wellness check," unquote. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced today that the Senate's annual August recess would be canceled. McConnell cited, quote, "historic obstruction by Senate Democrats of the president's nominees and the goal of passing appropriations bills prior to the end of the fiscal year," unquote, as reasons for his decision. The August recess is frequently used by members of Congress to raise money to bolster their reelection funds. DNC Deputy Chair and Congressman Keith Ellison announced that he will be running for Attorney General of Minnesota. The move came after incumbent State Attorney General Lori Swanson failed to secure renomination at last week's Democrat Farmer Labor Party convention and announced that she would be running for governor instead. Ellison will continue his job at the DNC during the campaign. Mexico retaliated for recently imposed U.S. tariffs with trade measures of their own. The newly announced Mexican tariffs target U.S. pork, apples, and potatoes, along with some types of cheeses and bourbon. The Trump administration is embroiled in a deepening multi-front trade war that also includes the European Union, China, and Canada. Those are today's headlines. Next up is an in-depth discussion of the 51st anniversary of the Six-Day War in Palestine. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
But first we turn to Palestine. People around the world yesterday mourned the assassination of a 21-year-old Palestinian medic Razan Najjar, who was shot and killed by Israeli snipers as she was tending to wounded protesters. Razan is the second health worker killed by Israeli snipers and one of more than 100 Palestinians killed in just the past few weeks. The Israeli military said they would conduct an investigation into Razan's death. Also, today marks the 51st anniversary of the Six-Day War, also called the Arab-Israeli War, which was a quick and decisive victory of Israel over its Arab neighbors and which greatly expanded the territory under Israeli control. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen. We're also joined from Washington by Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko also has a new book out called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be with you.
Dan, let's start with you. Thousands of people showed up for Razan Najjar's funeral today. Thousands of people, many people who didn't even know her. She's being hailed as a hero internationally. Doctors Without Borders has made a statement. The United Nations has made a statement. Every once in a while, there's a killing in Israel or in the Palestinian territories that's transformative. Do you think this is one of those times?
Well, I think Razan Najjar is a person who really captures the essence of Gaza in terms of its resistance and dignity. And if you watch, there's a couple of videos circulating, one from Safa, a Palestinian media outlet, where she's at the front lines of the Great March of Return, where she had been, tending to wounded protesters for, every week since the beginning. And then there's another video that the New York Times, of all places, published after she was killed, where you see her speaking so eloquently and bravely, and really you just see that, she embodies everything about Gaza and the Palestinian struggle. And I do think that, yes, definitely she is one of her death is kind of a transformative moment. And I think we really saw that actually at the UN, the General Assembly, when, U.S. Ambassador to the UN and neocon Nikki Haley was begging member states to vote for the U.S. resolution condemning Hamas instead of, allowing the Kuwaiti resolution calling for an investigation into the killings, into these killings week after week, which the U.S. Has blocked. So, on one hand, we see Razan Najjar's incredible display of dignity. And then on the other hand, we see, just from the U.S. and Israel, we just see this ugly face of imperialism and on decline and really isolating itself as the rest of the world just, doesn't really want to have much to do with this just total slaughter.
Yeah, I think that it's an issue that is going to take on a life of its own, frankly, whether it's in Gaza or in New York. I think this is something that is not going to end anytime soon. We're talking also about Nakba Day and how important it is in Palestine. That's why these killings have taken place, because Palestinians have protested for the right to return and to take back their land. But there are Palestinians there who are wearing white coats and who are acting as medics and ambulance drivers and such, and the Israelis are still shooting them. The press is saying that this is all part of an Israeli policy. The policy is to shoot people in the legs. They're not shooting them in the legs. They're shooting them in the head or in the torso. So with the American resolution aside and the Kuwaiti resolution aside, how do you think this plays out in New York and the rest of the international community? Is there going to be international pressure on the Israelis to stop or to back off?
Miko, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Israel seems to be getting away with murder for a very long time, and I don't think we're going to see an end to it. As tragic as this particular killing was, at the end of the day, it's one more Palestinian dead, and Israel seems to be getting away. I mean, there's no, when Ayat Tamimi was arrested, and the whole drama that went around there, everybody thought, oh, this is going to be some kind of a turning point. It really wasn't. And now this wonderful young lady is shot and killed, treating patients, treating the wounded. Israel keeps going. Israel is doing strong. Netanyahu is in Europe this week meeting with Angela Merkel and meeting with Macron, and he's going to London at the end of the week. I mean, he is you know, Israelis have never had it so good. So on the one hand, they continue with the slaughter. On the other hand, the entire international community seems to be welcoming Netanyahu with open arms. And so I don't think we've seen the end of it yet. Not at all, unfortunately. And regardless of what the United Nations resolution might decide to do, what votes they might decide to take, we haven't seen the end of the horrors at all. And it's interesting, you know, this is the 51st anniversary of the Six-Day War. And in many ways, it's quite symbolic that 51 years later, Israel is still maintaining the kind of playing as though it's maintaining some kind of a moral high ground, whereas in fact, it's violating every international law. It's abusing the rights of Palestinians. It's killing, it's occupying, it's breaking every moral code that we could possibly think of and getting away with it.
Let's talk about the anniversary. 51 years ago, the Israelis carried out what might be called a blitzkrieg-like attack, lightning attack against Egypt and Syria and Jordan, Lebanon. And it was in that war, Dan Cohen, that the Israelis seized the West Bank. They seized the Golan Heights. They seized Sinai, Gaza. 51 years later, after many, many, many UN resolutions condemning the occupation of additional Arab lands as a consequence of that war, the Israelis are, you know, not heeding any of those resolutions. In fact, have annexed the Golan Heights, are virtually carrying out the de facto annexation of big parts, the most important parts, perhaps, of the West Bank, of Jerusalem. They were, as a consequence of the Camp David Accord in 1979 with Egypt, they left the Sinai, driven out of Lebanon by resistance forces, but they were there for about 20 years. This was a decisive moment in history, Dan, because it also marked the beginning of the full, I would say, 100% embrace of the Israeli government's expansionist designs and all of its designs by the U.S. by the U.S. political and military and intelligence establishment. Before that, say in 1956, during the 56 war, where Israel sided with the support of Britain and France, invaded Egypt. The U.S. didn't approve of that invasion. But after 67, almost everything that the Israelis have done has gotten a blank check. In other words, starting in 67, it seemed like Israel became a pure extension in some ways of American power. Anyway, walk us through some of that history, if you would.
Well, yeah, as you said, in 1967, Israel launched a massive attack on the Egyptian Air Force as a war of choice. And it was, popularly portrayed as Israel just defending itself from these surrounding Arab armies that were going to invade. But if you look at the record, it's really not true. There was a lot of division among the surrounding Arab countries, and Israel was not under any real threat. Israeli society was just kind of withering at that point. The economy was not doing so well, and young Israelis were actually leaving the country, seeking opportunity abroad, and the kind of colonial settler spirit that, filled the Israeli public for years after the establishment of the state and the ethnic cleansing had kind of subsided. And so 1967 really kind of provided a shot in the arm for the country. And since then, it was a massive expansion to, they occupied the West Bank and began the colonization there, the Gaza Strip, which, eventually Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon withdrew from the Gaza Strip, essentially because he saw it strategically as better to lock, millions of Palestinians in there and focus on colonizing the much larger and resource-rich West Bank, rather than keeping, a few relatively small settlements that required massive amounts of resources in Gaza. And what Dove Weissglass, who was an assistant to Ariel Sharon, said at the time was it was putting the peace process in formaldehyde. So no peace process could advance, but it was popularly portrayed in Western media and continues to be as some kind of overture to peace that the Palestinians rejected. But that's, around the same time, you know, shortly after, Hamas was democratically elected by the Palestinians of Gaza, and the U.S. basically attempted to engineer a coup and lost. And so then Gaza was put under siege. And then a few years later, 2008, 2009, we saw these massive attacks, you know, Operation Cast Lead, and then what do they call it, Pillar of Cloud, and then Protective Edge in 2014, and, you know, massive airstrikes and just wiping out huge swaths of Gaza that have led to the point that Gaza is at today, with these massive protests of people just demanding not only their right to return, because most of the Palestinians of Gaza are refugees, you know, expelled from what is now Israel in 1948 and 1967, but also, you know, it's the material conditions they live in. It's you know, having 3 to 4 hours of electricity per day, and, you know, that slowly decreasing as a matter of Israeli and Egyptian policy. It's not having clean water. It's just, you know, having no human dignity, no way to survive. On the other side, we have, you know, Israel and Syria. In 1967, Israel occupied the Syrian Golan Heights and ethnically cleansed the vast majority of it and began colonizing it. And that's a process that has gone on to this day. Israel has, you know, sought to keep Syria weak, as well as Lebanon. And the stakes have gotten higher. And I think, you know, we've seen that these countries, Syria and Hezbollah and Lebanon, are able to really fight back. And even the resistance in Gaza has been able to, you know, give Israel a bloody nose. In Egypt, you know, with the Sisi coup, that has basically installed a you know, pro-Western dictatorial regime that works on essentially on behalf of Israel and the U.S. So on one hand, Israel, if it wanted to be, is in a pretty good situation internationally with unbridled support from the U.S. But because it's by its nature just seeks to continue to expand and dominate the region, I think, you know, it's eventually going to kind of the tables are going to be turned, and, you know, the forces, the countries around it are more united, and it's isolated internationally, aside from, you know, some EU states and you know, the U.S. giving it unbridled support.
Dan, talking about the Golan Heights, you know, when I was an undergraduate working on a degree in Middle Eastern studies, we were all taught that the reason the Israelis took the Golan Heights and would never give the Golan Heights back was because they were heights and they overlooked Israeli territory, and it was easy for Syrians to shoot Israeli settlers that were down below. But then in 1997, in an interview with the New York Times, Moshe Dayan, who was the defense minister during the 1967 war, said something. I'm going to quote it here. He says, "Of course they wanted the Syrians to get out of their face." He's talking about settlers. "They suffered a lot because of the Syrians. Look, as I've said before, they were sitting in the kibbutzim and they worked the land and they had kids and lived there and wanted to live there. The Syrians across from them were soldiers who fired at them, and of course they didn't like it. But I can tell you with absolute confidence, the delegation that came to persuade Eshkol to take the Heights was not thinking of these things. They were thinking about the Heights land. Listen, I'm a farmer too. After all, I'm from Nahalal, not from Tel Aviv, and I know about it. I saw them and I spoke to them. They didn't even try to hide their greed for that land." So it was about the land. It wasn't about security. It was about expanding arable land for the state of Israel. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the major points, and you're right. It's been falsely portrayed as, you know, as Israeli actions often are. It's all about security. It's like, well, we have to conquer the entire region and install puppet regimes around the region for the sake of Israeli security. I mean, the other thing I would point out is there's also large amounts of oil and gas in occupied Golan Heights that I believe. I'd have to look at the name of the company, but Dick Cheney, none other than Dick Cheney, has been involved in. And so it's essentially just plundering of resources. And, you know, that's going on right now. Israel just stealing resources that belongs to Syria, which, of course, very much needs it, as it is doing with natural gas found off the coast of Gaza. And Israel is also in the Golan Heights. It is expanding its kind of, you know, sphere of influence, if we can call it that, by funding on the essentially Syrian-controlled side. It is funding and, you know, delivering aid and weapons, I believe, to so-called Free Syrian Army groups, basically a series of disparate groups battling the Syrian government who have worked, you know, hand in glove with Al-Qaeda and ISIS in order to keep the Syrian state weak. And, you know, it's just a very clear collaboration between Israel and, you know, very radical groups that is hardly talked about in Western media, but, you know, should be, in my mind, a huge scandal.
Let's turn also to the peace process. Let me ask you the most basic question right off the bat. Is there a peace process?
Well, there has been a facade of a peace process, you know, where supposedly Israel makes these overtures and then the Palestinians reject it. But if you look at what Israeli offers actually consist of, where they're brokered by the U.S., which has finally revealed itself, you know, completely under the Trump administration to be completely 100% on the side of Israel. And that goes for a long time. I mean, back in the early 2000s, the prime minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, was recorded saying America is an easy thing to move. You know, it's easy to basically manipulate the U.S. And, you know, that's aside from the massive kind of open influence that Israel has through AIPAC and, you know, various organizations. But the peace process has just been a facade for more and more settlements, colonization, the siege of Gaza, and rising fanaticism. I think, you know, one of the very important things to understand about the peace process is the genocidal pulse through Israeli society that we see from, you know, ostensibly secular elements to the religious fanatics who, you know, I've recorded openly calling for genocide of Christians and Muslims around the region, all the way from, you know, Jordan, Turkey, Iran, all the way to Turkey and Iran, in ISIS-style conquest.
That's the voice of Dan Cohen. Dan is a journalist and filmmaker. His latest work is Killing Gaza, new film that's out with also made with Max Blumenthal. We're joined again from Washington, D.C. by Miko Peled. He's the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko also has a new book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land, Foundation 5. We have about 5 minutes left. Miko Peled, you were a very young person in Israel, I believe, at the time of the 1967 war. Talk about it from the point of view of its transformative impact on Israeli society?
Well, I was very young, but my father was a general at the time, and he was a member of the Israeli High Command during the war. And so the weeks and the months leading up to the war were very, very dramatic times, and my dad was right in the heart of this storm, of this atmosphere that led to the war, that eventually allowed the war to take place, and that was very intense. And the sense was, immediately when the war was over, which was, of course, very fast, was, you know, great elation. You know, once again, we, the children of the Maccabees, were able to, and the descendants of King David, were able to defeat the evil Arabs who came to attack us and wanted to destroy us and so forth. But as, so I spent, in the General Son, I spent quite a lot of time talking about that and also going through the Israeli Army archives to really understand what was taking place, the minutes of the general, of the meetings of the generals and so forth leading up to the war. And what has become very, very clear, if it wasn't clear then, it's certainly become clear over the years, is that the taking of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and of course East Jerusalem, was not something that anybody ever intended to be, temporary. This was completing the job that should have been done, at least in the eyes of those generals, should have been done in 1948, but for reasons, you know, whatever took place in 1948, they decided to create the West Bank, to create the Gaza Strip, and not to include them in the State of Israel. 1967 came around, and they did what they called finishing the job, which is finishing the job of the conquest of the land of Israel. And from that moment on, they went on to build massively for Jews only, to de-Arabize, to continue massive campaign of ethnic cleansing that was already going on in other parts of Palestine. And what is quite ridiculous is that today people talk about the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as the occupied Palestinian territories, as though the rest of the 80% of Palestine that was taken 20 years earlier, in 1948, is somehow not occupied. But the sense that this was going to be, this was permanent and it was not going anywhere, was prevalent immediately. And the building for Jews was immediate. And the destruction of Palestinian towns and villages and neighborhoods in East Jerusalem and all over the West Bank, and in the Golan Heights, by the way, was immediate. So all this talk about those particular areas being somehow different than any other parts of the country are really part of this, you know, part of this charade that somehow Israel will one day allow the Palestinians to have their own state, and there could be an Israeli-Palestinian peace, which, of course, we know today is absolutely not true. But those were, you know, that was really in many ways, that period reminds me of what is happening today with Netanyahu going on and on about the threat from Iran, where it's quite obvious that there is no threat, but the fact that he keeps talking about it and building it up, there's a sense of this impending disaster. And this was the same thing leading up to the 67 war. The generals wanted popular support, and they wanted the government support to start the war. In order to do that, they invented this notion of a massive existential threat, an impending threat, which necessitated the preemptive strike, which they eventually were able to receive permission to do. So it's very, very similar in many ways. Hopefully, this time it won't end up in a war, because that would be disastrous. So, but you see how these elements, Israel continues to act in a very similar way, even all these years later, and get away with it.
Miko, we have 30 seconds left. When you said they got permission, who do you mean they got permission from?
From the civilian government. I mean, the government, the Israeli cabinet was hesitant, very hesitant to about starting the war. And the generals, who were much younger and a very different kind of Jews, very different kind of people, were eager to start the war and defeat and destroy the Arab armies once again. So there was this tug of war that went on for quite some time between these two power centers. And my father made a name for himself as one of the strongest voices demanding that the government allow the army to do its job and start the war. So it took some time, and finally there were some political changes taking place, and they call it an almost military coup. It wasn't quite a coup, but the demand by the army was very, very fierce, and eventually the government succumbed and gave them the okay to start the preemptive strike, and then, you know, that was it.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen. We've also been joined from Washington by Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko Peled has a new book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us from San Francisco. He's a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, John.
I want to start by talking about Howard Schultz. Howard Schultz is the wildly successful CEO of Starbucks. He's the one that led Starbucks into becoming the international behemoth that it is. But he resigned yesterday, and the speculation is that he wants to run for president. What do you think of that?
Yeah, this is a really odd new trend that we're starting to see more and more. If we look back and can remember, Zuckerberg, who's the CEO of Facebook, had a instance in which he created an LLC where he gave all of his shares over to the LLC rather than own them himself. And it was posed as this big charity stunt and him giving away all this stuff, but really the LLC was fully in his control, and what it looked like, it was for him to remove conflicts of interest so that he could run for public office.
Don't you have to be 35 to be president?
Yeah, I don't know if he would be running for president per se, but some kind of public office or something like that, where, you know, you couldn't be the active CEO of a company like this. There was also a move on his end where he was trying to talk investors into allowing him to maintain control of shares but not have voting rights on them, which is like unheard of for a number of reasons. And it was ultimately scuttled. But that was a really odd thing to do. Short of running for public office, it doesn't seem to be any logical reason why you would want to do that. But what we're seeing is this really odd trend now. We've always known that, you know, the CEOs, the billionaires control Washington, and they do it through lobbyists, and they do it through think tanks, and they do it through donations. And they've, you know, typically been content to allow these public figures to sort of protect their interests. What we're seeing now, though, is this kind of aggressive new wave where CEOs and those, you know, who have wealth like them are simply just running for office. Perhaps Trump is the most current example where, you know, he's just a wealthy real estate magnate with no background in politics and or limited background in politics. And all of a sudden, you know, he's the president of the United States. It is going to, in some ways, I see it as kind of almost a sort of decay of our political system where rather than this sort of kind of public face or frontery where we try to pose the current democratic process as something that's, you know, free and fair and we pick the best person for the job, to where now corporations are just going to say, no, we'll just be in charge of this too. We'll have our CEOs in charge of this. You know, it's like the Secretary of the Treasury, which the last three have been Goldman Sachs executives and CEOs, where there's this just clear connection between the corporate world and between the public world. And, you know, I think we're going to see this trend. I mean, there was a brief period where everyone was saying Oprah for president, right? And Oprah, of course, has no background in public office. She's a billionaire, extremely successful television personality, owns her own network, and would just step in and, you know, ascend to the heights of power. And this, you know, this is a continuing attack on the democratic aspects of our society where, you know, at least in theory, at least in paper, you know, we're electing officials given a wide range of choices, and that in theory anybody can be in public office. And now it seems like they're not even really interested in kind of propping up that myth. They're willing to just have people step into these roles, these billionaires, and they'll just ensure that the governments run like a business, you know, with a maximization of profit and a minimization of loss.
I wonder if some of these billionaires that we haven't even really discussed yet smell blood in the water. And think, well, if Donald Trump, of all people, can get himself elected president, I can too. I could see Howard Schultz saying something like that. I could see Mark Cuban saying something like that. And then, you know, every 4 years, Michael Bloomberg flirts with the idea of running for president as an independent. I wonder if 2020 is going to be the year that that we have, you know, easily two dozen people on the Democratic side running for president and a bunch of them end up being billionaire businessmen.
By the way, Mark will be eligible to be president by 2020. He'll be 36 then.
There it is. God knows he can self-finance.
By the way, when the U.S. this is really tangential, but when the U.S. Constitution adopted this law that you have to be 35 years to serve as president, the average life expectancy was 36. Anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at the Mark Zuckerberg's age being perfectly lined up for it, you know, and you see him starting to kind of make some moves. Now, granted, the whole kind of Russiagate Facebook controversy has probably scuttled that possibility of that campaign significantly, which may have in part been intentional. I'm not sure. But can you imagine, you know, this one-time CEO of Facebook, this website that's responsible for such a huge portion of political advertising, having their CEO or one-time CEO running, you know, for president? I mean, it's insane. You want to talk about meddling in the election or something like that.
It's too much. It's actually too transparently bad. I mean, that's the whole thing about the current. I know we have other subjects, but, you know, since we're talking about another CEO running, let's just spend another minute. It's really disadvantageous for the social, or let's say the political elites, to have billionaire corporate CEOs being the president of the United States, because ultimately things go wrong in politics and everybody turns against the incumbent. So, okay, we turned against Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Donald Trump was, even before he was elected, people, a big part of the country had turned against him. So people learn to hate the politicians, and that's fine because the politicians come and go. But the CEOs are still the CEOs after the fact. And the class that they represent, the billionaire class, which has so much political clout, they want people to hate politicians. They don't want people to go around and say, God, I hate billionaires. Mm-hmm. We should get rid of billionaires. Billionaires have no place in our society. I mean, that's actually a radical message. It's much better for the billionaires to be represented by this coterie of sort of opportunist, self-serving politicians who can be cast aside whenever they become too hated.
I think that really the Trump effect, along with these other effects, is sort of unmasking, you know, what an unfair kind of stacked against the deck system this is. And for at least for progressive people, as unpleasant as this is, as unpalatable and dangerous as it is to have people like Donald Trump in office, it is waking up more people to the realization of who's really in charge here and what are the values really. It's ripping off this very pleasant mask that can be placed over all of that, where we can say, don't worry, we're still the best in the world. It's okay. Just kind of go back to sleep and vote in the next 4 years or whatever. And I think there's a huge advantage to it because, yeah, as people see more and more of these billionaires in charge and realize really what they're interested in and what their goals are and how blatantly racist, sexist, anti-worker, et cetera, they are, the more people are starting to become political and starting to get involved, and the more unacceptable it will be to them.
I want to change subjects here and turn to trade. There's a very interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal. When was it? Today, yesterday, talking about six G7 finance ministers. Well, it says here, representing some of the closest allies of the U.S., issued a stern rebuke of the protectionist policies of the administration of President Donald Trump, signaling a deep rift in the relations underpinning the post-World War II trading system. There was so much news this past week about sanctions, and it was coming from everywhere. Sanctions, trade sanctions on Mexico, on Canada, on China, on the European Union. And as the article says, these are some of our, well, not all of them, but at least in the EU, these are our closest allies in the world. And we're punishing them now, arbitrarily and unilaterally. Where do you see this going, Daniel? Do you think the Trump administration is going to continue this policy of levying trade sanctions and tariffs on our closest friends?
I think it's really important when we analyze the kind of trade situation and the constellation of forces that we really kind of look to the Trump administration and understand where they're coming from and why their motivations are. Because I think it upturns so many decades of U.S. foreign policy where, you know, our allies in Europe, we forge really strong bonds with them and we're very careful not to step on their toes or overly strong arm them. And now suddenly we're in a world where that's absolutely not the case. The Trump administration represents a particular kind of anti-globalist nationalist ideology. And that ideology and its views come first in determining what decisions they make. Real politics and the actual constellation of forces and powers only come into play when they truly block the ability of the administration to carry out certain things, when they truly take a sort of decisive action against it. But until then, they're not going to be concerned with the sort of practical matters of empire as much as they're going to be concerned with trying to turn back the clock, really, to an age which, frankly, didn't really exist, where it was just the U.S. on its own against the world. You know, that time didn't exist, but it's this idea that we were our own economic power on our own. We only looked out for ourselves. Other countries came second, and we would only engage in deals with them if they, you know, benefited us first. And so what you're seeing is this all-out assault on countries as varied as China and then all these European countries, then Canada, which is one of the United States' closest trading partners and has been for a long time, and then, of course, Mexico, where it's just this all-out assault on all of them. It's strategically idiotic. If you're going to go after a country as powerful as China with as much influence as it has, you want your allies on your side. You want them, you know, rooting for you. And right now, even if Trump, you know, steps back the tariffs on Europe or steps them down, it's still incredibly humiliating for these public officials over there to so openly be shown to be in the pocket of the U.S., to be completely discounted by the U.S. It's extremely disempowering and hurts them politically. And yet that's what we're seeing, because the idea is that we're going to carry out this massive turn back in time. To, you know, the 1950s where, you know, only men worked and people of color knew their place. And we had, you know, this strong industrial sector and we didn't outsource it to any other countries. You know, it's not possible. We can't turn back time. Globalization has happened. There's a huge economic network now that spans the globe. And this is only a pipe dream at best, that we can somehow transform things back to the way they were.
One of the things that that the European finance ministers are objecting to in particular is this notion that's come out of the White House that the tariffs it imposed last week, this is 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum, were designed to address the role that steel imports have played in undermining the U.S. steel industry. And they're calling this a national security issue. The Canadians especially were upset about this. There was a great quote from the Canadian finance minister. He said, "Our absolute view is that this is absurd to think that Canada could in any way be a security risk to the United States." But that's the theme that the White House is running with, that it has to levy these tariffs because the steel industry is critical to the national security, and so we have to protect it. The problem with that is that now there's talk that we're going to apply that same language to the car industry, that we have to all of a sudden protect the auto industry because it's vital to national security. So, Daniel, where does this end?
Well, I think it's important to understand the reason why they're choosing the national security angle is because it allows the president to act with executive power and unilaterally. In other words, there doesn't need to be consensus in Congress, and there doesn't need to be a voting process. If it involves national security, there are presidents, sitting presidents are allowed to to simply impose these things. So that's a big part of why he's doing it, because he would never be able to successfully gain consensus by Congress to impose tariffs in a way outside of national security. So that's the main reason why he's doing it. But of course, you know, it comes off to all these allies as us, you know, implying that somehow they're a military threat to the United States, which is, of course, crazy. Also, it shows the kind of aggregation of power, because once you allow, you know, an individual president to use their own interpretation of what national security is, and what Trump is saying is that our economy and the success of our economy is essential to national security, and if our economy fails, then our national security fails. So it's really kind of all the same thing. And he's using that logic to sort of impose tariffs where he will, with little breaks that can be applied to it. So, you know, it's a really dangerous trend that we've allowed this degree of power to aggregate, you know, at the executive branch. I mean, there's many other examples that we could go into outside of trade where presidents are allowed to make these unilateral decisions. And of course, you know, it is a continual slap in the face of allies that we've spent decades, you know, building relationships with, and, you know, significantly reduces our global posture. I mean, it really weakens us. And, you know, whether Trump gets another term or whether we have someone, you know, very unlike Trump, there's a tremendous amount of damage that has been done, where these countries are realizing that a figure as disruptive as Trump is a possibility in American politics now going forward, whether he gets another term or not. And this will be a source of hesitancy, uncertainty with trading partners going forward, where they will always be kind of looking out of a corner of their eye, worrying that there might be another disruptive figure like this that will kind of throw everything into chaos once over again.
And we see that the businesses that are consumers of metals, meaning aluminum and steel, are also reporting that they're being hurt very badly, and that their supplies, because these are global supply chains. I'm not talking about how working people should look at this. I'm just talking about from a strict capital business point of view. Yes, it helps U.S. Steel, it helps aluminum, it helps Alcoa perhaps, but consumers, companies that rely on metals, aluminum and steel, they're losing their contracts because suppliers, the global supply network, they're going elsewhere because the costs are going to be higher in the United States.
That's right.
By 10% or by 25%. And so based on the fact that every capital decision is based on lowering expenses, maximizing profits, even if companies have had contracts for decades, those contracts are going to be lost. I'm looking at, again, this is another trade group. It's called Trade Partnership Worldwide. They're against the tariffs. They're estimating that as a consequence of the metal tariffs alone, aluminum and steel, and this does not include Canada and Mexico, could result in a net loss of 470,000 jobs after a year or two. So it helps, this policy helps steel, American steel companies, American aluminum companies, but it hurts a lot of other companies. How do you think this will play out, Daniel Sankey, politically for Trump?
Yeah, I think that there'll be a first, this big burst in excitement, right? I think the steel workers and aluminum workers have largely been ground down and hollowed out and forced to, compete with countries that they cannot possibly compete with. And so I think initially there'll be a lot of relief and excitement where working people feel like their jobs are a little safer and a little more profitable. The problem is, though, then there will be the downstream effects of all these other people losing their jobs, which will significantly harm, you know, like you said, many hundreds of thousands of working people. You know, right now, if you read the newspaper, the economy's humming and there's so many jobs out there and it's just, you know, a paradise for working people. But the reality is, of course, extremely different. The economy will contract. It always contracts. It will have a downward cycle just as surely as it has an upward one. And I think that these people that will be losing their jobs, it will be even more severe when there are, you know, cutbacks in profit due to a downturn in the economy, beyond just the job loss to the tariffs. So I think it's really just a big mistake for working people to fix their hopes to one capitalist group, say the steel capitalist, versus other capitalist groups that need those inputs as some way, you know, that you have to pick one of those sides and one of them is going to protect you and the other one's not. Really, these working people need to understand that there's no salvation in supporting these particular bastions of wealth and power, that it's just a moving around of resources, a jockeying for power, a competition between them. And in the end, it's working people whose jobs become precarious and whose jobs are threatened, which is what we're going to see. So I think especially when the next downturn hits, you know, in the next year or two, the job loss will be much more severe. And I think it will be very clearly laid at the feet of Trump and the Democratic Party, I mean, who very so publicly championed these extremely unpopular trade deals. I think it'll be very clear the connection between them and the state of the economy.
I'm looking at a story that's just been published by The Wall Street Journal, Daniel. China offers to buy nearly $70 billion of U.S. products to fend off trade tariffs. Beijing says purchase hinges on whether Trump imposes threatened tariffs. Now, Wilbur Ross in China, he's the Commerce Secretary. Liu He, President Xi Jinping's economic envoy, is representing China. These are purchases of what appears to be some manufactured products from the United States and a lot of farm goods and some agricultural products. Obviously, China is trying to avert a trade war. They're making concessions, but perhaps these concessions are actually not that meaningful in terms of what the Trump administration or the hawks like Peter Navarro or Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer are actually after. Your take on that?
Yeah, they want to reduce the trade deficit, which is, I believe, over $300 billion. So the $70 billion, while, you know, not chump change by any means, is still significantly less than this trade deficit. But, you know, it's ridiculous. We have trade surpluses with other countries, you know, such as Canada. So this is not to say that this is some kind of, you know, devastating effect on the U.S. economy. Yeah, China's trying to offer an olive branch. It's trying to say, hey, look, Trump, you'll get these guaranteed purchases. You'll be able to trumpet it to your base. You'll be able to look like you're a tough guy and you negotiated and you won. And in exchange, you're not going to put all these tariffs, which will, you know, effectively start opening up a trade war. We'll see how it works because China's dangling the carrot and the Trump administration is obviously very willing to go with a kind of very hard right, uncompromising ideology, regardless of how practical the compromise is. That being said, China is extremely adept at diplomacy, extremely adept at negotiations. I think they've been able to take advantage of a lot of the fallout from the Trump administration in securing trade deals with other countries who are growing more frightened and wary of the U.S. and its erratic nature. So I think they might be able to work this one out with him. But, you know, nothing's guaranteed. I think that he's fully willing to push some kind of trade war with China, as devastating as that would be, provided there isn't enough opposition at home. So we'll wait and see. I mean, they're dangling out the olive branch. We'll see if Trump takes them up on it.
Daniel, does it really matter if we have a trade deficit with these countries? Like, what's the practical implication of having a trade deficit?
Yeah, I think that's really important. So deficits and trade deficits can be bad, but they're always portrayed, you know, by these kind of far right shifts that they're just bad by definition, that we should never be taking in more or buying more from a country than we're selling them. But the truth is that when you buy from a country, which the U.S. buys a tremendous amount of goods around the world, that makes us their primary consumer. That makes us their primary customer. And that gives us tremendous power and influence on the global stage. We are the world's biggest consumers, and we use a lot of funds and debt financed by other countries to in turn finance our purchasing habits and in turn make a lot of money for these investors in these other countries. And we stimulate their economies by buying all their goods and products. So, you know, it's portrayed as this horribly devastating effect to the United States, when really having a trade deficit like that is only a problem if the other country stops selling to you. But here's the thing. China needs to keep selling to us. All these other countries need to keep selling to us. They have to be able to turn a profit. And if for some reason, you know, in some fantasy world, we can imagine that they would stop. I mean, that's impossible. Their economies would fall apart. Their profitability would collapse. So I think it's really disingenuous to portray the trade deficit like it's this tremendous American weakness, when in fact it is a tremendous sign of strength and influence that we have over the global economy.
I want to turn to something that, you know, that may seem boring, actually, to some of our listeners. It's complicated, but it's very, very important. And that's the issue of banks getting a reprieve from the Volcker Rule. We've talked about the Volcker Rule on this show a couple of times, but Daniel, can you tell us why this is so important?
Yeah, it's extremely important. The Volcker Rule essentially makes it illegal for commercial banks, consumer banks that hold funds for people like you and I, working people, like a checking account, a savings account, to gamble using those funds on speculative or high-risk investments. What it says is, hey, look, if you're not holding wealthy people's money, you can only invest that money in very safe, carefully regulated investments. For example, investments backed by real property, like real estate or something like that, where there's a real piece of land and a home backing the loan. Now, you don't make a ton of money on these investments, but conversely, you don't lose much money and they're very safe. Now, there's high-risk investments that make a ton of money for banks, and banks like them, and there's a lot of risk. You can go bust. You can lose your money. And only accredited investors, i.e. high-net-worth people, can invest in these, and banks can only use their funds in these more speculative investments. The Volcker Rule really separated out those two worlds: safe investments for working people, high-risk investments for wealthy people. But now, by getting rid of this, what it's allowing these big banks to do is to gamble in speculative investments using working-class people's funds. Banks love to do this because that's a lot of money they have on the balance sheet. And while there's a lot of risk, there's also a lot of profitability, which the banks, of course, will enjoy. So this rule was put in place in the post-2008 crisis to try to prevent another collapse like we had, because that's exactly what happened in 2008. These very safe investments we call mortgages became extremely unsafe because they were turned into CDOs and credit default swaps and derivatives and all these complex, risky financial products that eventually tanked the economy. So it turned a very safe investment, a mortgage, into something very speculative. This is setting the stage for that again, and is rolling back regulations that make it impossible for banks to do things like that. So it's a huge win for big banks like Chase and Citi, et cetera, and a continuing weakening of Dodd-Frank. We're going to see a continual chipping at it over the next 5 to 10 years as they try to take little pieces of it apart until the Dodd-Frank Act, which was the act to prevent another 2008-style crisis, is really kind of shredded and returned, you know, back to a kind of useless set of principles and propositions. So this was a big win for banks, and it essentially allows them to speculate using our hard-earned money in our checking and savings accounts.
Daniel Sankey, since you're an economist, well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to – that sounds like a pejorative. You're a financial policy analyst. Economists always get it wrong when they're predicting things about the economy. So I didn't – no offense meant, okay?
But
I want to ask you to make a prediction. Is there going to be an economic recession coming soon? And the reason I'm asking you this is that I'm looking at another Wall Street Journal article from today, June 5th. Economists, again, a hated category, economists think the next U.S. recession could begin in 2020. Majority of forecasters surveyed by Wall Street Journal predict the current expansion will end only after setting a record for a longevity. Now, that means the recession began in 2007. It ended around 2008 formally. It's been a long time. That would be 2020 would be almost 12 years, almost 13 years since a recession. That's almost the longest time between recessions. And of course, recessions are a characteristic feature of this particular economic order, capitalism. But let me read you the first paragraph. The economic expansion that began in mid-2009 and already ranks as the second longest in American history likely will end in 2020 as the Federal Reserve raises interest rates to cool off an overheating economy. Overheating because not so many more people are working, apparently. Like, that's bad for businesses because there's not that reserve army of unemployed people that keep wages down. The labor market is tightening. People should be able to demand higher wages. That's bad for business because if wages go up, that means money that would be otherwise accrued by the owners, the profit makers, the profit takers, that may go down. Some 59% of private sector economists surveyed in recent days said the expansion was most likely to end in 2020. Anyway, I put you on the spot about making economic predictions, but that cushions it. 1 minute left.
I think 2020 is too generous. I think it will happen in 18 or 19, frankly.
Wow.
And I think we see this big expansion. I think we need to ask the right questions. In many ways, the Bernie Sanders movement and the Donald Trump election are representative of the fallout of the catastrophe in 2008. Has the recession really ended? Who determined it ended? Well, a bunch of very well-paid economists determined it was over, and now they've determined it's gone on, the period of growth has gone on longer than it ever has. But for working people, the people who are attracted to these ideologies that talk to them about, you know, their plight, they're not seeing a turnaround in the economy. They're not seeing something transformative. So I think the fallout from 2008 still hasn't played out. I think it will continue to play out. And I think even a dip, you know, in profits, even a minor recession will have huge explosive effects in the political phase as the working people are really just fed up and sick of the business as usual politics that they're seeing in this day to day. So I think the fallout will be sooner.
And certainly tightening credit, more expensive credit, is an indication that the banks at least expect the business cycle, this phase of the business cycle, to be coming to an end.
Yes, absolutely. That tightening of credit will prevent the balloon from continuing to grow and shows that banks are getting ready for it to burst, and they should know.
Okay, that was the voice of Daniel Sankey. He joined us from San Francisco. Daniel is a financial policy analyst, and he joins us every week to talk about the economy. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.